In the old days in China, when they were the Chan or the Zen tradition in China, there was a Zen master whose name was Tree Nest Master, the Tree Nest Master, because he liked to meditate up in trees. So he had this name. And one day the governor of the province came to see him, or came by or something, and he said, looked up at him in the tree and said, you know, it's really dangerous up there. And the Zen master looked down at the governor and said, it's a lot more dangerous where you are in your position. And he said, no, I don't think so. That's the case. You're the one who's up in the tree. And then the Zen master said, well, in that case, you don't really know your mind and heart very well, do you? And then the governor said, you know, what's the essential teachings of the Buddha? And the Zen master said, to avoid doing evil, to cultivate the practices of the good, and to purify the mind. This is a very, very ancient little teaching that goes back, you know, to the very beginning of Buddhism. And the governor said, even an 8-year-old child knows that. And the Zen master said, even though an 8-year-old child might know it, an 80-year-old person might not live it. And that's the end of the story. And so there's a few things here. One is, where is the real danger? And the Zen master is trying to say that the real danger resides inside of yourself. There's a real danger here if we succumb to hate, if we succumb to greed, or if we let fear get the upper hand and we act out in paranoid ways that are not very helpful to anybody, including oneself, that we provide ourselves our greatest danger. We ourselves are, in some ways, our greatest threat. We're our greatest threat to the well-being of our heart, or, well, you know, what's going on, our sense of wholeness within ourselves, a sense of being wholehearted. And one of the teachings of Buddhism is that our hearts, this wonderful kind of sense of integrity or wholeness or deep sensitivity and that can reside within us, is only really harmed by ourselves. There might be causes and conditions around us which are somewhat are atrocious, you know, terrible things that happen. But that if we succumb to hate, or if we succumb to greed or to fear or all these different kinds of forces within us, and we start indulging them or acting on them or living by them, that we are then causing harm to ourselves. So there's one famous teachings of the Buddha is, if you get angry, you're doing your enemy's work for. You're pleasing your enemy. You're doing a harm to yourself that your enemy could never do to you. Implying that, you know, enemy could be angry at you and do all kinds of terrible things to you, but the enemy really wants to hurt you. And when you get angry, then you're doing something inside of yourself that's causing you pain and suffering. And that pain and suffering of being angry is kind of doing your enemy a favor. So again, this pointing this way in which, in some way, I'm not going to argue here it's universal or it's all, you know, it's all the ways we suffer come from how we really, you know, our own way to we treat each other, ourselves. But one of the important aspects of Buddhism is this way of becoming a caretaker of our own heart or our own mind or our own inner life, and recognizing the ways in which we harm it ourselves and the way that we can benefit it and support it and nourish it. And one of the very foundational teachings of Buddhism for this purpose is that of ethics, of morality, of virtue. And we find in the Buddhist tradition tremendous emphasis on the importance of living an ethical life. And this little teaching that the Zen master gave the governor in the essential teachings of the Buddha, to avoid evil, to cultivate good, to practice good, and to purify the mind, that's, you know, kind of an ethical teaching, to avoid evil and do good. And then to purify the mind. It's very central to Buddhism. And the word for this virtue, or the word for morality in Buddhism, the word is sila. And sila sometimes has been etymologically connected to the word a bed or a foundation, a foundation stone for a house or something. And it's a real foundation for our lives. The Buddha said once that if you harm other people intentionally, if you go about intentionally through cruelty or ill will, harming other people, you are destroying your own foundation. The foundation, you know, that supports you, nourishes you, that supports this inner kind of life. And traditionally in Buddhism, the teachings on ethics and morality are supposed to be taught first. And as I was coming down here today, I was reflecting how for many years in Palo Alto, I taught the introductory course in meditation on Thursday evenings. I would just interrupt the regular Thursday evening kind of sitting group and then do a 5-week introductory course. And always the first week, I'd start with meditation on the breath, the introduction. Maybe many of you have taken the course that I've taught. But for many, many years, the week before I taught the intro class, I would give a talk on ethics, on the precepts. And in my mind, like I told people who were there, but in my mind, the 5-week class was really a 6-week class, and it started that day. And but you know, if we advertised, you know, like, you know, introduction to ethics, you know, people aren't, you know, be so interested in that. People want, in our culture, our societies, they want the benefits of mindfulness and meditation. It's fine to do that. What many people find after practicing meditation for some time is that there's a kind of a sense of inner, and this is my own language, I mean, everybody will have their own words, ways to describe this inner sense, but inner change, whatever. Some inner sense of integrity that we touch, we feel, we encounter. Some sense of wholeness, some sense of well-being, some sense of compassion or love or goodness or something that we touch inside of ourselves. And when we touch inside of that ourselves, then it begins to become quite obvious how living in unethical ways becomes a way of harming ourselves. And the little thought experiment, which I often give, is imagine yourself going off into a wonderful hike on a wonderful, you know, maybe weekend afternoon, and it's a beautiful day, just the right temperature and comfortable, and beautiful sun and blue sky, and springtime, and the grass is like green, and beautiful wildflowers, and you go hiking, and you come to a wonderful place to stop for lunch, and you have just the right amount of food for lunch, not too much, and you lay down under this beautiful oak tree, and it's just so peaceful, so delightful, and you feel so satisfied and content, and you even maybe get a wonderful little nap, you know, short nap, and you wake up so refreshed and so cleansed in a sense, maybe. And your friend who's taking a nap next to you kind of wakes up at the same time, and you turn to your friend and said, you're a jerk, or you lie to your friend. Or you see your friend, you know, still taking a nap, and you see that your friend, you know, has this beautiful thermos. So you take the thermos and stuck in the bottom of your backpack, and your friend will never see that, you know, where it's gone. And, you know, in that kind of thought experiment, you imagine how you feel, the sense of well-being, the peace, and maybe a hope that it feels like a little bit grating, perhaps. It feels a little bit like it's against the spirit of how you're feeling. It's like I hope that's what you felt, somehow kind of a personal violence to yourself in that peace that you're feeling to cause harm to someone else. Then if you kind of forget that thought experiment and imagine yourself going down the freeway at 5:00 in the afternoon, you're late for a very important appointment, it's rush hour traffic, it's gridlock, you're actually standing still in the freeway, when you're finally able to move a little bit, someone cuts you off, and your air conditioner doesn't work, so your windows are down, and all the exhausts are going into your car, and it's just, you know, you're feeling you have a headache. And then one more person cuts you off, and how easy it is to kind of get angry, how easy it is to flip them off, or how easy it is to honk your horn some very aggressive way, or how easy it is to kind of, they're trying to get in, and you kind of force yourself forward. I'm not going to let that person in at all. You know, who's that person? And in a state where we're already agitated and quite, you know, harried and upset and frustrated, it can be quite easy to do something that's unethical and not to feel the cost of it, not to feel the effect that it has. Does that kind of thought experiment work for you? Does that make sense, the difference? Yeah? Kind of works? Some of you, it doesn't work? People, it doesn't work, you know, admit it, say it. Because I say this a lot, so no one ever gives me any feedback, so I should ask for it someday. Is this a kind of thought experiment that works as a teaching thing? And but I think that as people meditate, there tends to be kind of inner integrity or some sense of within ourselves that translates then to wanting to start living a more ethical life. Ethical life then becomes an expression of how we want to live. We want to safeguard, we want to protect this inner sense of well-being or integrity we have. Traditionally in Buddhism, because of that intimate connection between ethics and our inner sense of well-being, the instructions are you start with your ethics before you meditate. You try to clean up your ethical house. You try to live in a way that doesn't cause harm. And as you do that, you get a number of benefits. One benefit is that you're not doing anything intentionally through your behavior or through your speech that is causing harm to others. And in causing harm, you have nothing to regret in terms of hurting someone. You're not acting on those impulses. And acting on the impulses of causing harm is like, you know, it's like making the whole wound much stronger and more deeper. So if you start living an ethical life, that part of your life becomes kind of quieter and more peaceful and more at ease. You're not struggling so much with it. You don't have any doubts about it. What should I do in this situation? And you've kind of taken a commitment. You know, I'm going to live an ethical life. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to steal. I'm not going to kill. I'm not going to involve in sexual misconduct that harms other people. I'm not going to indulge in intoxicants that can cause a whole slew of problems once we get drunk. And, you know, you really have person has some real confidence that this is how they're going to live their life. And there can be, for some people, a tremendous sense of feeling safe, feeling some sense of well-being, and knowing they're not going to cross those kinds of lines because they made some kind of commitment. As we start living this way of crossing a line and being unethical, this in return supports the cultivation of this inner sense of well-being, this inner integrity. The outer integrity supports the inner integrity. So that's kind of like just, you know, that's one benefit. The second benefit is that as we start being interested in living an ethical life, and for lay Buddhists, it's often defined as being guided by the five precepts, the five training rules, the five trainings. Maybe it's the best translation into English, the five trainings. And the five trainings are not to kill, not to intentionally cause harm, not to steal, not to take what is not given, not to lie, not to be involved in sexual misconduct, which most people we understand is not use our sexuality in ways that can cause harm to others, and then not to indulge in intoxicants. So these are called training, the five trainings, and in using the word trainings, a lot of people like to then see the difference between the idea of commandments. There's some absolute moral rule that is being given from above and said, thou shalt, and if you transgress it, you've done a sin. It's a training that Buddhists take on to help them be more mindful, more attentive to what's happening. To give an example from the time I was a monk, there are all these rules. Monks have not five precepts, they have 227 to live by. And a lot of them are very simple things, what kind of dwelling you can live in, you know, and what kind of shoes you can wear, and how you eat your food, Like, for example, there are all these rules about how you're supposed to eat your food. You have this big bowl, and you're eating this bowl, and you're supposed to just kind of basically mix everything together, the desserts and the salads and everything, just eat it all, you know, without any preference for, you know, whatever. And there's certain ways of eating. And then one of the rules is, and you're not supposed to look into your fellow monk's bowl to see how he or she's eating. Because you can imagine, you know, the judgments that can go on. How could, you know. But, you know, so it's a beautiful rule, you know. The principle is pretty great, you know. You're supposed to follow this rule, but don't judge other people whether they're following it or not. Isn't that great? So there's a lot of rules for the monastics. And so when I was a monk, there were simple rules like you weren't actually allowed to pick anything up that was not your own. Unless in some ways it was offered to you or told, you know, it's okay for you to do that. Look at this, you know, whatever. And so you come into someone's house and you see something nice on the table, and like maybe it's a, what are these, what are they called, coffee table books? These conversational books, these books full of pictures, and, you know, people have you know, it's there for people to look at, right? And you feel the impulse to pick it up and look at it. It looks really fascinating what's there. But you have this rule that you're not allowed to pick something up as a monk unless it's been clearly offered to you to hold. That's not a, you know, an ethical rule per se, but it's a training rule. Because in knowing that you can't pick it up, you feel the impulse to pick it up, and you say, oh, I get to be mindful of what I'm doing. So having this rule sets a barrier, in a sense, or sets a limit, or it's like a mindfulness bell. Oh, I have to be mindful of myself, of my conduct and behavior when I come around coffee tables. When I come into these situations where I might pick something up. And I was really surprised when I became a monk how wonderful it was to live under these rules. Because how mindful it made me be. I went in 227, you know, rules. There were so many different situations where I would come into where somehow the rule applied. And I had to be attentive, I had to be alert. And I wasn't oppressed by it. But, oh, one more rule, I have to think about that. I actually felt more liberated by it. Oh, to be present and awake and really noticing what's going on. And then I noticed, for example, if I was going to pick up something like this book, I would notice the impulse to pick it up, and I'd refrain for a number of benefits. One benefit is there's a lot of strength, a lot of freedom that can come when we have cultivated the ability to restrain ourselves peacefully. To feel an impulse. Say, I don't have to go there. I'm going to do that. I can just let go, restrain myself. I know some people equate restraint with being suppressed and kind of being oppressed. If that's the case, then maybe you shouldn't restrain unless you're causing harm to someone. But the spirit in Buddhism is there's a way in which restraining ourselves provides freedom, some ease. If we're acting on impulse and on compulsion, then we're not free. So if we have a compulsion to shop, the American ideal would be find a shopping center and freely shop. That's what American freedom is about. Shop till you drop. And I'm free to shop. The Buddhist freedom would be free yourself from the compulsion to shop. You might still shop if you need to shop for good reasons, but the drive, the compulsion. So the mindfulness, the rule, you know, of, you know, picking up something, teaches this kind of restraint. It also becomes an opportunity, it also becomes a mirror for me to see myself at that moment. And it might be that there's some impulses which are not so pure, some impulses that are not so helpful, healthy, going into play in a situation. And by having some boundary that I can't cross, in a sense, it becomes a mirror for me to see, oh, that's what's going on in me. That's what's happening. So, I mean, maybe, you know, coffee books are not so interesting, but they say, but maybe they have some, you know, great Buddhist book on that table, the coffee table. I've never seen this book by a teacher that I greatly admire. I've never seen this book. And so I go to reach for it, but I know as a monk I can't actually do it. I'm not allowed to pick it up unless it said, "You look at it. You please look at it." And I'm not allowed to hint either. That's also out. So you have to really, you know. So there's a mirror. You know, why did I want to pick it up? And perhaps, you know, 10% of that impulse to pick it up, part of it is, that's what I want. I want this great Buddhist book to tell me how to get rid of my greed. You know, this impulse, you know, I see that impulse. And it's great to see it. It's great to be aware of it. And hopefully as you develop your mindfulness practice, you'll discover this great delight you can have in noticing what's happening. It might take a little while as you kind of struggle, and for a while, the old habits kick in, and you judge yourself. Oh, I can't believe I'm doing that again. Or, oh, gee, I'm such a greedy person. Yeah. But after a while, when mindfulness becomes really strong, there's a wonderful flavor of it where it's, oh, it's kind of, it's actually freeing in the moment of being mindful. So part of the idea of the precepts is to learn restraint, which is freeing. And the other part of it is to learn mindfulness, awareness of what's going on in deeper levels, which is also freeing. And the third benefit that I'll mention tonight is the benefit that living ethically is a gift we do for others. It said one of the greatest gifts you can give someone else is the gift of fearlessness. They don't have to fear you. You're not adding fear to the world. They can trust you. They feel safe around you. They can put their coffee table books down. They know they're going to be there when they come back. You know, it's okay. You don't have to lock it up or something when you show up. Or some equivalent to that. I remember when I was in Thailand, I lost my wallet at the entrance of the monastery gate. And this was a part of Thailand that was kind of the Wild West. I was told that most of the men in that part of southern Thailand had guns, and a lot of violence and a lot of stuff goes on there. And I said, you know, but it was, you know, the gate to the entryway to the monastery, and I'll never see that again. And not only was the abbot holding it, waiting to give it to me, but all the money and everything was in there. Everything was in there. The monastery was a safe place. So living ethically is a gift to others, and a part of the impulse to live ethically for some people is out of the impulse to be compassionate. And compassion is one of these wonderful qualities that seems to grow as we cultivate mindfulness, as we get more settled and more at ease with ourselves, less in conflict with ourselves, and more attentive in a deeper way. That compassion is as if compassion is an innate quality of the heart. If we just get out of the way, it will radiate forth. And if you start having little inklings of compassion, I think it becomes more and more interesting to try to live ethically. Not just ethically in the moment, but to anticipate situations where you might not be so mindful and where you might do something uncompassionately. Maybe, you know, in that rush hour traffic, you can be compassionate up in the meadow after a beautiful hike. It's easy. You can love all humanity. But can be compassionate in that rush hour traffic. Are there situations where you're really tested and where you might do something unethical? So part of the dedication to the precepts in Buddhism is not just to, you know, feel like the compassion is good when it happens, but when you start feeling compassionate, to kind of imagine into the future, in a sense, imagine situations where you need protection from, where you need preparation for, so that, you know, that you can continue offering the gift of fearlessness, of safety, of you know, coming from a compassionate place. So for lay people in Buddhism, there are these five trainings. And some lay Buddhists, will cultivate these, will work with these, explore these for quite a long time before they learn meditation practice. I remember the awe I felt when I met this a friend of mine when I was a student at Stanford. She was a Chinese, I guess she was Chinese-American now, but she grew up in China, in Taiwan, and in Thailand, and some in Japan, and mostly grew up abroad, but had come to America to go to college and become, you know, settled here. And she was quite a devout Buddhist. And she was actually studying with in the department. I was studying Buddhist studies at the university at Stanford. And she was also studying Buddhist studies. That she'd made that her kind of her thing in life, was to do Buddhist studies. But all Buddhism was her kind of thing. So this person was quite serious about it. And so I asked her one day, do you meditate? And she said, no, not yet. I'm preparing myself for that so that I'm worthy of it. I'm preparing myself so that I'm worthy to learn to meditate, in order to meditate. And I was kind of amazed. I'd never heard, you know, I spent most of my time, you know, practicing here in the West, mostly among people who were kind of what can be called convert Buddhists, who had not, you know, grown up as Buddhists. And the idea that you would put off your meditation because you were preparing yourself for it, purifying your conduct and your behavior and working on your precepts and your ethical life. My generation of kind of people coming out of the 60s kind of, you know, ethics was kind of like, you know, that wasn't so interesting. And, you know, we were going for the, you know, the real stuff, the important stuff, the transformational stuff, you know, that which was, you know, better than acid, you know. And, you know, so I was, you know, I was ready to bow to this beautiful woman. You know, I thought it was so beautiful. And I'm not necessarily recommending you spend years working on your ethics. And she was a very ethical person. It wasn't like she was an ethical person. But she was aware of the subtleties of these things, the subtle ways in which we take what's not given, the subtle ways in which we might cause harm and do these things. And so I think for we don't have to stop meditating, but I think it's very valuable to start seeing the interconnectedness between virtue and mindfulness and how the two really support each other. If you start trying to train yourselves by the five precepts, that training itself will strengthen your mindfulness because you have to be mindful in order to kind of live by them. It'll also strengthen your the inner sense of well-being and integrity for most of us. Some people who are kind of guilt-bound will often, feel so unworthy to begin with, which many people in our culture feel, that any emphasis on ethics and precepts can kind of sink them because, oh, I can't live up to that. And so maybe it's better not to start with ethics then. But generally, it's considered to be, you know, very helpful to work with them together, not to kill. It's beautiful. You go to retreat centers, and people have been meditating for some time, and they're very, you know, quiet, and they've taken precepts at the beginning of the retreat, and then some insect flies into the meditation hall, and you see these people, you know, they're supposed to keep silent too, and they go over there, and they go, you know, like this, you know, they're the most cherished pet, you know, or they take a piece of paper and they're very carefully. You know, and they're very mindful, and they're very careful in carrying it outside this little insect, and they open the door, and they, you know, it's, you know, they don't, not trying to kill the insects, but they feel that the insect's going to die if it stays inside this kind of environment. You know, there's nothing in here for it to eat. So let's, you know, I'll take it outside where it belongs. It might seem like maybe a petty thing, or to, you know, not kill insects, or take the insects and take them out of your house rather than to kill them. But when the sensitivity is deep enough, when the sense of inner integrity is deep, being settled on oneself is deep enough, being at peace with oneself is deep enough, not only does it feel better, but actually I believe there's a kind of a delight or joy that comes with that kind of compassionate activity. So not just simply avoiding causing harm, but the opposite expression of that is to do that which is compassionate in any situation. Each of the precepts is not just each precept, even though it's stated in the negative, not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, and so forth. The understanding in the Buddhist tradition is that the negative implies cultivating the positive. So not killing implies the cultivation of compassion. Not stealing implies the cultivation of generosity. Not lying implies the cultivation of honesty. Not misusing sexuality implies, I'm not sure what, restraint, treating each other with integrity and compassion, and not involved with intoxicants. The opposite of that is clarity of mind, cultivating a clarity of mind, and valuing that. One of the surprises I had when I went to Asia, Southeast Asia, was to meet Buddhists there who felt joy in their ethical conduct. And this was a foreign idea to me. In America, kind of growing up, I hadn't thought about it much. But if someone had, was being super ethical, they were kind of, we had kind of a derogatory term for them. They were kind of goody-goody. You know, it was kind of like, you didn't quite, somehow. And so the idea that someone would feel joy was a kind of a foreign idea, and delight. And that it's kind of a protection in a way of, it's an offering, it's a gift. So what is the quality of mind? What's the quality of the heart? Where everything I'm saying tonight resonates, speaks deeply, inspiring, kind of feels right. I know there are qualities of mind and heart where this seems ridiculous. Or just seems maybe kind of, why bother? Or, I'm already ethical, and what are you giving this talk about ethics for, All kinds of things that come up. But I suspect that in everybody's heart, there's some place where it feels really right to be ethical, to be compassionate, to live this way. Is that a place that you want to nourish? Is that a place that you want to feed and develop? Or you want to kind of overlook it or feel like it has no real value? What has value is competition, cutthroat competition, ambition, getting someplace, getting things in life, rather than cultivating that place within me, I could, go home and watch television. There's a lot of interesting things on television, I imagine. I don't know. I don't watch television. But, how many times does a person choose to watch television over doing something that's as beautiful as cultivating their compassion? Which is more valuable? What among all the choices we do, what we do, what does it feed? What does it develop inside of us? So the last thing I'll say about the emphasis on ethics or virtue or this integrity that's part of the Buddhist tradition is that it is not meant as a kind of self-righteous kind of approach. It's not meant to be being moralistic in some ways. It's not meant to in any kind of way be oppressive or a burden. It's really supposed to speak to that part of our life, that part of ethics, where it's a liberating movement towards joy and compassion, something that we delight in. If you don't feel that delight, don't feel that joy, you have one or two choices if you want to, explore this world of ethics and the trainings of the precepts. If you don't feel the joy in it, one choice you have is to chuck it and go back to the way you were. The other choice you have is to study, why is it you don't feel joy? Is there something that's getting in the way of that? Is there something else that's happening instead? And really bring your mindfulness really clearly and see what's going on here. Am I lazy? Is it too painful to do this because I tend to be self-judgmental in the process? I'm worried about what my friends think. If I start carrying the insects out of my house, my friends are going to think I'm gone cuckoo. What is it going on there with you? And that's, a mindfulness practice to explore that. Exploring these five trainings, being guided by them, being trained by the five trainings, is really the first instructions for a beginner who wants to learn mindfulness meditation. And you just got it. So what do you think? What's your reactions to this talk? What's your thoughts about it? What's your questions? Yes.
What would be the Buddhist attitude towards having stolen once, or lied once, or God forbid, killed once?
There's a variety of things that Buddhist resources might point to. One is that rather than feeling guilt about something, the point would be to be forward-looking. And not linger in the past in order to feel guilty and bad, but look into the future about how you can do better in the future, how you can avoid doing those things in the future, how you can maybe be compassionate and be helpful in society rather than, you know, so, you know, something like that. There was a, I know some of you might have read it to around Palo Alto, but there was this young 17-year-old boy who was killed in a car accident about 2 weeks ago Saturday, I think. And his best friend was driving the car. They were apparently speeding, phenomenal speed, going up into the mountains, I think. And maybe he was in passing. He was passing someone, maybe passing in a curve or something, and they ran into a truck. And the driver survived amazingly, and went in and out of the hospital a little bit, but basically will be fine. And his best friend, who was sitting next to him in the passenger seat, died. And I'm not sure if it was a funeral, but one of the first things that the father of the dead boy said was, as I was told, was, there's no blame here. That's a kind of amazing thing, the first thing, because he's taking care of other people, taking care of himself and everyone. There's no blame here. You can imagine how that father would feel, you know, and, you know, if his son was killed basically by someone. There's no blame here. And the next thing he said was, I don't know if the next thing he said, but what part of what I was told he did was he set up a fund, kind of like a scholarship fund or something, a little foundation, I guess, to have money in it, to in his son's name, to offer people scholarships. I don't know exactly what it was. And then he made, I don't know who all the people are who became the board of that foundation, but the boy who was driving was put on the board. And how I know this is that one of our Sangha members' daughter was these two boys' best friends. She was supposed to be in the car, but something happened. She couldn't be there. And her two best friends were these two boys. And she was distraught. And he put her on the board, too. And so here, part of this legacy of this guy is that, you know, they're not just simply feeling their grief, but they're also, you know, thinking about how they can continue the spirit, of this boy who died into the future. I can take his goodness in a sense and do good into the future for it. So to be forward looking in some way. Depending on what the person has done, we have to be very honest and look, you know, are those forces within us still there? The force to lie or to steal or to kill, are they still in there? Are we likely to do it again? And then the Buddhist approach would be try to work on those forces within us. Either try to uproot them or try to develop yourself in such a way that they no longer have any force over you. Another thing a person might do is, depending on the magnitude of what happened, it might be necessary to make some kind of amends. One of the very powerful things to do is act of confession. And it could be to go someone who feels a confidential confessor. Someone say, you know, I need to tell someone about this, because unless I tell someone about it, I'm going to hold it inside of myself, and I want someone else to be the witness that I know that I did this, I know that it's wrong, and I'm committing myself not to do it anymore. And sometimes that kind of confession really necessary in order to kind of a ritual, turning the corner. Sometimes it's necessary to go back and apologize to someone. I've known many people who started a meditation practice, and memories of 20 years ago, what they said to someone comes up. They haven't thought about it for 20 years. And there's a feeling that in order for the spiritual life to deepen any further, the person has to go somehow back to that person and apologize. And to call them up, remember me? No. Well, I want to, anyway, well, that's okay. I want to apologize for what I said once. And if it's the fact that, if someone's killed, then the amends, might take much more serious forms. It might be that if a person's, it might take, might mean going to jail, willingly go to jail, say, this is what I need to do, or something. And not for other people's sake, but because it's really what's necessary in order to somehow do something for oneself and to right what's there, to make amends. I was very touched many years ago when I saw the movie Gandhi. And I don't know if this is a true story in the movie, but a lot of the Buddha movie was based on truth. Near the end of his life, after the independence of India, there's these Muslim-Hindu riots going on. And it's a very difficult time for India. And Muslims are killing Hindus, and Hindus are killing Muslims. And Gandhi goes off someplace where a lot of this rioting is happening, try to stop it. And he encounters I forget exactly what it is, but I think he encounters a Muslim who comes to him for counsel. And the Muslim says something like, I've killed someone. I killed in the rioting, whatever, I killed him. A Hindu child, or I killed someone. And, what should I do? And Gandhi says, find an orphaned Hindu child. This is a Muslim he's talking to. Find an orphaned Hindu child and raise him as a Hindu. And, the shock and dismay in this Muslim's face, just because of what that means. But Gandhi, I guess, my understanding of that, Gandhi had some sense, in order for this man to be healed from what he had done, he had to atone for it, he had to make amends in some way that was very powerful. And the only way he could do that was to raise someone, was to do something, like to raise someone else in that religion that he had killed people in, make them personally a good Hindu or understand. So that idea, sometimes you have to make amends to what we've done. So there's a whole series of things, answers to your question, depending on the magnitude of it. If you finally realize, if it's been 30 years ago that we did something horrible, and you realize that your heart's completely been transformed and changed in that time, then there's a different response that's needed, different thing that happens, perhaps. Does this make sense, what I'm saying? Is this a satisfying answer?
So is the notion of confession embodied in Buddhism?
It occurs in Buddhism.
In terms of
a procedure, there is for the monastics. The monastics have a particular. They go to another monastic and aham bante sabe apatiyoro koyomi aham. Hey, elder, I would like to confess my transgressions. And then there's a whole way in which they do that. For lay people, there's no particular procedure that's been laid down, but there is an understanding that acknowledging one's transgressions to someone that you respect and really making clear to that person, I've done this, I don't believe in this, and I'm now committing myself not to do this again. That little state, that little thing is something which is understood to be very, very important and effective. It's not codified in any of that way. It's like in the wisdom tradition, and you can pick that up if you'd like. And you don't find Buddha saying you should do this, but it's there. And then you have to find the person to do it in, do it for. And if you've killed someone, especially if it's recently, then there's all these issues of confidentiality, and it gets a little bit more complicated in our society. But if it's if it was a long time ago, I met a few people in my life who came to me and told me they had killed someone. And Both people, they were soldiers, and they both had to do with World War II. So the time they told me, it was long after. One was a soldier, and one was a person who went through concentration camps in Indonesia. Japanese captured the Dutch and put them in concentration camps. And when he was released, and he was treated awfully, and many people were, and there was one particular prison guard, and it was awful, the torture or whatever. And when the war was over and all the Japanese were being sent back to Japan, him and his buddies went and found that guy and killed him in cold blood. And I don't know, I'm telling you this, but it was so long ago, and I didn't know what to say. I mean, he wasn't coming to me as a Buddhist teacher. He was actually a kind of acquaintance, a kind of distant family friend of people I know. And he was telling me his story. And I was, what do you say to someone who said they've killed someone? I just let him continue his story as it developed. It was so long ago. But, it didn't sit right with me that he just told it matter-of-factly and then moved on with the rest of the story, even though it was so long ago. And even though he thinks, he very much feels like he had just cause, it was really necessary. Yes?
Well, a few things. One is, I appreciate the idea of restraining yourself as a way of liberation. I look forward to that. So that you don't have to have everything. I like that idea. But I feel like, two things. One is, I get angry fast, especially when somebody's in my face. And I have an example recently with a little car thing. Somebody I was driving, she got out of the car and opened the door and hit the guy's car near us, just by opening the door, and he was furious. Just furious. And I got furious back at him, being furious at me. But I feel like I've done all this work. And it still comes boing. The button's pushed and if somebody would yell at me here now after I've meditated, I'm fine. I can be really cool, But when I'm surprised, or even when I'm teaching, but when I'm surprised by it, I might as well be 2 years old again.
Uh-huh.
And I'll smash the guy's face if I could. All that energy just is there, regardless of my years of meditating. I notice that.
Uh-huh. Has it improved over the years you meditated, or no difference?
Oh, it has improved with aging.
Oh, the aging.
I don't
want to hurt
other people.
Uh-huh.
In a moment, I forget. Uh-huh. I just respond.
Well,
it hasn't.
I
think
that, it's one thing to meditate. It's another thing, a whole other thing, actually much more difficult and actually maybe the more important part of all this spiritual life, is to take what you feel in meditation, the sense of calm or the sense of integrity or sense of being mindful and sensitive and attentive, and to try to live that way in your daily life. And some people kind of are quite dedicated to meditation, but as soon as they get up, they forget that about the whole stuff, and they just go off and do their life, and you can get very busy very quickly. But what does it take to be settled in yourself so that when you go into any kind of situation, you're not surprised by anything? I remember when I was a Zen student, we would sit, Zazen for many hours, and one of the Zen teachers had a custom of going around and sometimes would come and adjust your posture. And you come up from behind you, and very gently, he was very, very gentle, you feel his compassion, just very gently lay his hands on your back at first, kind of warn you there, and then kind of maybe a little adjustment to your posture, sit up, so you sit up straighter. And And he would, it was very interesting that when I was present, really present and settled in myself, he could come up. I had no idea he was coming up, sneaking up on me. And I'd feel that hand, and I would just feel soft. It's like the hand was going into cotton. If I was lost in my thoughts, and he came up and touched me, then I'd be startled. So one of the things to study is what does it take to be more settled in a deeper way in daily life? And do you want to? Is there enough? Is it high enough priority or value for you to really take to have that being settled or being at peace throughout your day that you might have in meditation? If you're relying on osmosis, that you do meditate and then somehow that has effect the rest of your day, then that's great. But if you really want to take the spiritual discipline to heart in a very deep way, it has to be more than that. You have to go and, you know, start meditating daily life in a sense. And then to study, for example, what is it that the world's experience is hitting inside of you? If you come along a situation and something happens, you're only going to react if that strikes something here in you. If it doesn't strike anything, in a sense it goes right by. And that's maybe after you meditate, maybe you're that way. What is it that it strikes? And there's a very important investigation to be done to explore what is it that's there before you get angry. That is already a wall or something, you know, a button or a trigger, we say. What is it? And to really spend a lot of careful time discovering what that is that's before you get angry. And then begin to take some responsibility for that and work on it and see, you know, what can you do about that so that to settle it or so it doesn't get in the way. Is this speaking to you?
Yes, I'm very willing to try. I spoke to somebody who was a monk at Plum Village, and he said he felt there was no way to lead a normal life, like 9-to-5 kind of job or whatever, something like that, and for him to keep his heart open. And that's why he went to Plum Village. And I was really struck by that, because the pacing of our lives here, you know, I'm driving somewhere, I'm tired, I'm cranky, it's too hot, there's too much traffic in San Francisco. You know, I mean, all these little things. So anyway.
Yeah. So it's true. So sometimes we have to make behavioral change. Some people think they can just kind of live their life and then add this wonderful thing to it and make everything. Sometimes we have to have behavioral change in order to be sane enough to, you know, get enough exercise in order to be, you know, if you don't get enough exercise, then it's easy to be triggered by all kinds of things. It's all kinds of things. So some behavioral change is really necessary. It's unreasonable not, you know, to... and then it has a lot to do with what your highest intentions are, or your deepest intentions. And then it's one thing to know what they are, and then has a lot to do also with the strength of that intention, the strength of motivation to live by that. A lot of people have deep intentions, lofty intentions, but there's no strength behind it. They're really going to live by it and act by it. If a person's intentions are strong, they really want to act on it, I think almost any situation, a lay life, 9-to-5 job, it can be done.
Thank you.
Good luck. I wish you well, really. So let's take the last 2 minutes and just sit quietly and compose yourself before you get in your cars. So thank you very much, and I wish you a wonderful week.